first time following the retirement of Lord Derby. As things turned out, it proved even more greasy than he expected, because at the general election a few months later, his Tory party was defeated and Gladstone came to power. This week, it seems Maggie Thatcher's had rather more luck as far as climbing oily pinnacles is concerned. She's not only climbed to the top of the greasy pole, she's managed to stay there, hasn't she? And that with a degree of adhesion, her opponents must be wondering what her brand of super glue is. However, I suspect you know that even the Iron Lady was not unaware of that precariousness in high office when she sat, perhaps not quite biting her fingernails, in the tension of the early hours of last Friday morning. For politics is a greasy pole. Only with great effort does anybody advance up to prominence, and the tiniest slip, relaxation, the fall of the dice of electioneering the wrong way, and one is sent spiralling downwards into obscurity once again. It's a bit like the Red Queen says in Through the Looking Glass. It takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that. That, I think, is what makes the career of David that we've been studying together such an outstanding one. See, he began life as a nobody, a rural shepherd boy, overshadowed by his older brothers. And yet by the end of his life, he had not only become king of Israel, he had secured the throne in the face of tribal rivalry and palace conspiracy, he'd subjugated all his enemies, including the powerful Philistines, he'd founded a dynasty which would last the best part of 500 years. And perhaps most amazing of all, he'd actually created a legend out of which the promised Messiah and the hope of a kingdom of God to come would be born. Oh, no doubt David was idealized and romanticized, as heroes often are. But in terms of climbing the greasy pole, there can have been few political careers to match his. And today in 2 Samuel 7, we arrive at what was, at least in the mind of the inspired historian who wrote this book, the summit of David's achievement. In 2 Samuel 7, David has at last arrived at the final rung of the ladder. He's reached the top of the tree. See how he begins. The Lord had given him rest from all his enemies and settled him in his palace. So that seems a good point, a vantage point, if you like, from which to survey David's rise to power and try to discover some of the secrets of his success. It's a relevant study, that, for us today, because I guess quite a few of us here will be launching out into careers of our own very shortly. We have our own greasy poles to climb. And whether in commerce or industry or even like David in politics, there are important and profitable lessons that David can teach us. If you want a subtitle for this morning's address, maybe it should be How to Be a Success. And we're going to break our study into two halves, looking at that question. The first half I'm calling The Way David Got to the Top of the Tree, or The Strategy of a Successful Man. And the second half we're going to call What Did He Do When He Got to the Top of the Tree? The Ambition of a Successful Man. Well, will you follow it then with me? Let's look first of all at the way he got there. And we'll take as our launch pad for this in 2 Samuel 7, verses 8 and 9. Tell my servant David, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I took you from the pasture and from following the flock to be ruler over my people Israel. I've been with you wherever you've gone, and I've cut off all your enemies before you. Now I will make your name great, like the name of the greatest men of the earth. So according to that, David's success was in a very real sense not a personal achievement at all, wasn't it? It was a divine gift. You see the prominence of all those first-person singulars? I took you, I have been with you, I have cut off your enemies, I will make your name great. And it's true, one of the principal things you notice as you survey the whole story of David's rise to power is that in so much of it, God's direct initiative can be seen. It was, after all, God who, through the prophet Samuel, had summoned David to be Saul's successor and anointed him at a time when the idea of being king could not have been further from the young man's mind. It was God who, by an extraordinary stroke of providence, brought David to Saul's court in the first place as a minstrel. Do you remember? Without David having to move a muscle in pursuit of his own self-advancement. Of course, David's own abilities were not unimportant. His good looks, his musical gifts, his skill with the slingshot, his charm with the ladies, all these things contributed to his rise to success. But when you compare David's political career with that of many kings in the ancient world, there's one thing that's very clear. There is a very notable lack of intrigue, lack of chicanery, lack of foul play. There's no attempt to manipulate people or events for his own advantage. One is constantly struck by the way David was willing to wait God's moment rather than try to create his own political destiny. Now, of course, not every politician would be happy to do things that way. In the 15th century, a young envoy of Duke Borgia in Italy made a special study of the art of government. His name was Machiavelli. And his book, Il Principe, The Prince, has been a handbook for ambitious statesmen ever since. This is how Machiavelli describes the methodology of political success. Everyone admits, he says, how laudable it is for a prince to keep his promises, to live by integrity and not by cunning. Nevertheless, the experience of our times has shown us that those princes who have accomplished great things have set little store by integrity and have deceived the minds of men by their cunning. And in the end, they have overcome others who kept their promises. See, according to Machiavelli, the only way to get to the top of the greasy pole is by sacrificing morality on the altar of political expediency. Politics is a dirty game, and only those willing to play dirty stand any chance of scoring, he says. And if we're to be honest, I think we have to admit that at one point in his early life, David may have been tempted to subscribe to that somewhat cynical point of view. You may remember in our last study, we saw David forced by the murderous jealousy of Saul into becoming the leader of a band of outlaws. That was back in chapter 25 and 26 of 1 Samuel. During that time, there was one occasion when he indulged in what I think we can only call Machiavellian tactics. I'm thinking of the 16-month period during which he sought political asylum with Achish, king of the Philistine city of Gath. You can read all about it in chapter 27 of 1 Samuel if you want to have the text in front of you. Achish, of course, being king of Gath, was hardly the sort of ally you would expect the man who killed Goliath of Gath to seek. But he did, and that shows you perhaps how dangerously hot David's position in Israel was becoming. He felt he had no alternative but to go into temporary exile. And Gath was just about the only place where he knew even the long arm of Saul couldn't reach him. Fortunately, Achish, though undoubtedly a powerful warrior, was not particularly well endowed with grey matter. David had learned that on a previous visit, when he'd escaped being executed by Achish after he was recognized by pretending he'd flipped his lid and throwing a fit on the floor in front of Achish's throne. You can read about that back in chapter 21. But this time it wasn't going to be so easy to fool Achish, because you see, David was alone then. Now he had 600 fighting men with him. Walking into Gath with that kind of retinue is a bit like Gerry Adams turning up in Westminster with a truckload of Armalite rifles. To put it mildly, it would need some explanation. But such was David's plausible tongue and no doubt Achish's gullible mind that the astonishing diplomatic coup was achieved and David was allowed to stay in Gath. He was even given a city as his base. The story, of course, that he told Achish was that Saul had so angered and antagonized him that he decided to defect and to offer his services to his much-respected former enemy. It was a lie. And even Achish was not such a fool as to be taken in by a subterfuge like that without supporting evidence. He needed to be convinced of the loyalty of his new vassal. And so David commenced what must be one of the most tortuous strategies of political survival that any politician, ancient or modern, has ever tried to sustain. What he did was this. Every so often, he would take his guerrilla army south, well away from Gath, and raid one of the desert tribes in the Sinai Peninsula. Then he would come back, laden with valuable plunder, and when green-eyed Achish asked him, David, where'd you get all this booty from? He would say, I just nipped over to Judah and destroyed one or two of their outlying villages. You know, not bad stuff, is it, Achish? Like a couple of camels or a new suit or two, would you? What Achish didn't know, of course, was that while David was stringing this line along to him, David was privately sending gifts from the very same booty to those very villages in Judah which he was pretending to have attacked. And by this means, you see, he managed to dupe Achish into thinking he'd rendered himself utterly loathsome to his own people by his treachery, and at the same time to retain his popularity with his own people by cultivating the reputation of being a kind of Robin Hood-style benefactor to them. It was a brilliant ruse, wasn't it? You've got to give it to old David. There was, in fact, only one problem with playing both ends against the middle in this crafty way. David had to be absolutely sure the truth never got to the ears of Achish. If it had done, it would have been quite literally more than his life was worth. So when he raided these isolated desert tribes in the south, he had to pursue a policy which was no credit to him at all. Verses 9 and 11 of 1 Samuel 27 tell the facts with chilling candor. Whenever David attacked an area, he did not leave a man or woman alive, for he thought they might inform on us and say, this is what David did. It's tempting to try to excuse this policy of slaughter with remarks like, oh, well, life was cheaper in those days, wasn't it? Or by pointing to the times in holy war in the Old Testament when God actually commanded the destruction of a city or something like that. But it's very doubtful whether David's actions here can really be defended on either of those grounds. For a start, the killing of women was explicitly prohibited in the law of Moses on military practice. And these campaigns of David could not fall into the category of holy war, because if they had done, then plunder would not have been permitted. So it's quite clear that these holocausts were not motivated by moral outrage, nor even moral ignorance. This was simple moral compromise on David's part. He couldn't afford a security risk, that was all. It was ruthlessness in the best traditions of Machiavelli. And I suspect that in that subtle narrative skill with which he so often makes his points, the author of 1 Samuel intends to tell us that it wasn't really a very good idea, this policy of David's. He does so by showing us how David's geese came home to roost, as it were, by the cruel hand of Providence. There are two lessons David learned in subsequent chapters in 1 Samuel that both flowed out of this very dangerous policy. The first you find in chapter 29. The ploy with poor old King Achish, you see, came so close to backfiring, it must have sent shivers down David's spine. Achish had been so hoodwinked by David, he wanted to make use of David's forces in a direct attack on Israel. That put David in a very tricky spot. Fortunately, the other Philistine kings were less convinced of David's change of heart than Achish was, and so vetoed the idea. And so David was able to bluff his way out of the situation. But he must have breathed a very deep sigh of relief at being let off the hook in that way. For if he had been forced into a position of joining forces with the Philistines against Israel, it would have spelt political suicide, wouldn't it? Either he would have had to try to sabotage the Philistine attack, thus blowing his own cover, or else he would have had to actually take part in the action against his own people and forfeited forever their trust in him. That little rhyme of Walter Scott about the tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive is all too true, true of politicians as much as anybody else. David could not have come so close to political disaster without realizing how dangerous the policy he'd been pursuing was. But Providence had an even bitterer lesson to teach him in regard to those murdering raids of his on the desert tribes. If you turn on to 1 Samuel 30, you'll read of how the Amalekites, who were one of the groups who were the victims of David's attacks, struck back at his base camp near Gath while his troops were out on patrol. Like David, they burned the village and captured all the plunder, but unlike David, they took the women and children alive. When David and his army got back to their base camp and discovered their loss, it precipitated one of the most dangerous crises in David's whole career. We read that the men were so distressed at being deprived of their possessions, and most of all of their wives and their children, that they talked of stoning David. And if it had been the corpses of their wives and children that these strong men had found that tragic day, perhaps they would have stoned him. As it was, the mercy of the Amalekites gave David the opportunity to recoup the situation by recapturing the lost goods and personnel, which he went on to do. But if the Amalekites had treated him the way he had treated them, then that ascent of the greasy pole would have been terminated very rapidly for David. It was an ironic providence, was it not, that day, that gave David a taste of his own medicine and the painful and hazardous consequences of it. And perhaps it's significant we don't read of any more atrocities performed at David's command after that incident. Indeed, always round, those 16 months of trying to do it Machiavelli's way in Gath seem to have burned David's fingers. For we find no further attempts at intrigue throughout the early part of his career anyway. Indeed, there are several pointers in the remainder of the story from this point on that indicate just how distasteful those kind of tactics had become to David. If you look on into 2 Samuel, for instance, there's his reaction on the death of Saul. In 2 Samuel 1, we read that there was a certain Amalekite who thought it was his lucky day when he happened to witness Saul's suicide after the Battle of Gilboa. "Oh," he said, "no need for me to tell the truth. I know what I'll do. I'll pretend I was the one who dealt the fatal blow to Saul, and I'll take the crown off his head and bring it to David. Any would-be king will richly reward such a messenger and such a trophy." When he got back to David, he got short shrift from him. Look at verse 14 of 2 Samuel 1. David asked him, "Why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Your blood be upon your own head," he says. So saying, he had the unfortunate fellow executed. See, David would not allow himself the slightest glimmer of satisfaction in the death of Saul. He even wrote what must be reckoned one of the most beautiful and famous laments in Hebrew literature to express the genuine sense of tragic loss he felt. "How are the mighty fallen," he said. David simply didn't revel in the death of his enemy, and he liked even less this kind of opportunism that sought political advantage by means of it. There's a second incident that tells the same story in chapter 3 of 2 Samuel. That's the story of Joab and Abner. Joab was David's commander-in-chief. But unlike David, he didn't have any scruples about the use of violence for political ends. He was a kind of Judean mafia, was Joab. If anybody got in the way of him and his brothers, they killed them. Abner was a case in point. Abner had been Saul's commander, but when he realized that David was going to rise to power, now Saul was dead, he decided to change sides. And he actually tried to negotiate with David so that he would persuade the tribes that were still loyal to the house of Saul to accept David's rule in exchange for a general amnesty. And that suited David fine. We read in chapter 3, verse 22, he sent Abner away in peace, agreeing to the proposal. But when Joab heard about this arrangement, he was furious, because in the days of the civil war, Abner had killed Joab's brother in battle. And Joab was sworn upon revenge for his blood kin. So Joab, with malicious deliberation and in total defiance of David's wishes, plotted the murder of Abner and executed it in cold blood. Now, politically, that was an advantageous death for David again. For Abner was a risky ally while the embers of the civil war with Saul were still smoldering. But once again, we see that David took no satisfaction at all in the act. He totally dissociates himself from Joab. He pronounces a solemn curse on his family. He leads the mourners at Abner's state funeral and even gives the funeral oration in his honor. Some people argue that David should have taken even firmer action against Joab. It seems Joab got off the murder rap on the legal grounds that he was engaged in a blood feud, which was legal in Israel. But judging from the last verse of chapter 3, verse 39 of chapter 3, it seems there were political factors too that prevented David from bringing charges against his commander-in-chief. Today he says, "Though I am the anointed king, I am weak, and these sons of Zeruiah," that is, Joab and his brothers, "are too strong for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil deeds." But even if David's hands were tied in some respect, in a way they shouldn't have been, at any rate we can say this, that in the sordid business of revolutionary politics, where men of violence counted themselves as David's friends as well as his enemies, it's a remarkable testimony to how consistently David sought to keep himself free of blood guilt. He didn't want to do it the Machiavellian way, though most kings in his day would have done so. And you can find a further incident in 2 Samuel 4, the murder of Ishbosheth, which teaches the same lesson. Well, the cynic, of course, can point out that David's refusal to rejoice at the death of these enemies of his was diplomatically shrewd. It would help to placate any residuum of support for Saul. They would undoubtedly have cherished a grievance against David if they thought he'd personally been involved in these murders. But the fact remains he was not responsible for these deaths, and all the evidence indicates he was genuinely distressed by them. And if you ask, well then, why was that? Why was David that kind of man? Well, it's because David, for all the ruthlessness of which he was capable, was at heart a spiritual man. Fundamentally, he was motivated not by a lust for power, but by an honest desire to do God's will in his life. And that's what God is saying to him in 2 Samuel 7. "He is my servant, David." The monarchy for him was not a political ambition, it was a divine calling. Because God, who had taken him from following the flock and brought him to this high office, and David knew it. David was relieved of the burden of achieving his own political goals by Machiavellian tactics. And in a very real sense, that is the first and primary reason for the scale of his success. Let me be quite frank with you. If you go into politics or industry or commerce today, you're going to have to be tough. As David was tough. For there are an awful lot of people trying to get onto the top of that greasy pole, and they don't much care who they trample on to get there. Of course, you could adopt their tactics, the tactics of Machiavelli. And if you did adopt those tactics, you might well achieve a measure of success. But I suggest to you it wouldn't be a secure success. It would be the sort of success which is purchased by insomnia and ulcers and coronaries. The sort of success that must be forever looking over its shoulder, as Joab must have been forever looking over his shoulder, for the stab in the back. It'll be the sort of success that brings temporary prestige, maybe, but no lasting satisfaction. If you really want to be successful, as David was successful in his life, the first question you must be asking is not, what do I want to do? What's my ambition? The first question you must be asking is, what is God calling me to do? Just as he called David to do a job. There are some folks, of course, who think that the only people who have divine vocations are clergymen. Well, that's nonsense. The Bible teaches us that every Christian must treat work as a calling. Whatever you do, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus, says the apostle, whether you're a slave or a master, whether you're an employee or an employer. Work with all your heart, he says, working for the Lord, not for men. Maybe God will call you to be a secretary, or a builder, or a banker, or a teacher. Maybe he wants you to be a housewife, or as I'm told we have to call them nowadays, domestic engineers. Maybe like King David, he wants you to climb the greasy pole of a political career. Maybe like the Apostle Paul, he wants you to carry the cross of missionary service. But whatever he wants you to do, have no doubt about it, it is his calling, just as certainly as the monarchy was David's calling. You must use your gifts in the pursuit of that calling as David did. You must exploit all legitimate opportunities in its pursuit as David did. To be a servant of God is not to be passive, still less lackadaisical about one's career. And it should not diminish one's zeal or application in any measure whatsoever, this thought of it being a calling. But the fact that it is God's calling that you're following, and not just your own personal ambition, will dramatically affect one thing in your life. It will affect the importance of promotion to you. If you're going to get to the top of the tree, then let it be like David, because God has put you there. Not because you've clawed and elbowed your way there over the battered bodies of the competition. Learn the lessons that David did in Gath, that deceit and cruelty in the end get you nowhere. But patience and faith in the end will get you anywhere. Anywhere, that is, that God wants you to go, and being a Christian, you don't particularly want to go anywhere other than that, do you? The way he got there. That's the first thing I want you to notice about David's being at the top of the tree. He let God build his career for him. That is the strategy of a really successful man. And that brings us to the second half of our study. What he did when he got there. The ambition of a successful man. Because David did have an ambition. But not the one you might have thought. Look at verses 1 to 3 of 2 Samuel 7. When the king was settled in his palace and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies, he said to Nathan, "Here I am, living in a palace of cedar while the ark of God remains in a tent." The latter half of David's life is haunted by one great dream, the temple. More than anything else, David wanted to leave behind him a people and a culture that revolved around the worship of God, the temple. He knew from the law of Moses the importance of a central religious shrine as a focus of national and religious unity for the people. And he very early decided where that shrine ought to be in the new state he was fashioning, Jerusalem, the fortress of Zion that he'd captured from the Jebusites. That was the ideal spot. David knew the place. But the Mosaic law didn't give any indication what sort of shrine ought to be there. Moses, of course, had erected a tent in the wilderness, a kind of portable church, a porter church. The tabernacle, as it's usually called. But that was in their nomadic days, you see, when they were always on the move. A tent was obviously appropriate then, wasn't it? But now that the land had been settled, David had bigger ideas. He wanted to build the most beautiful palace of worship the world had ever seen. It offended him that God was represented by nothing more than a goatskin marquee down the road, while now he was living in timber-clad luxury. It was all the wrong way around. He wanted to put it right. Some kings would have made it their ambition to build universities and libraries. Some would have been building fortresses and missile silos. Some kings would have been building palaces and parklands. But this king, above everything else he wanted to do, wanted to build a church. A temple that, by the grandeur of its architecture and the wealth of its decoration, bore some testimony to the glory of the God to whom it was dedicated. And that, I suggest to you, is the second great reason for David's prolific success. See, if you like, you can pursue the ambition of affluence. You can make money your goal. A yacht, a mansion, a Rolls. If you like, you can pursue the ambition of high office. You can make power your goal. A director's desk, a seat in Westminster, a university chair. you like, you can pursue the ambition of becoming a celebrity. Make fame your goal, like those people on television. A name that will live forever, quote. Yes, the newspaper headlines, the Broadway lights, a Nobel Prize, maybe. If you like, you can pursue the ambition of domestic happiness. Make family your goal. The bringing up of children. The digging of the garden. The decorating of the bathroom. Your such ambitions may gain success of a kind. But even the noblest of those ambitions, and some of them, of course, have great merit, I'm not saying they don't, even the noblest of those ambitions can generate a very short-lived success. The sort of success that lasts till the kids grow up, till the illness strikes, till retirement arrives, even at the very best, till death, that inevitable hour. It's the awful thing about death, isn't it? It casts a shadow of meaninglessness over the whole of life. Was it Gray's Elegy says, "The paths of glory lead but to the grave." Too true. Ever told you the story of that French boy who stood up during the Paris riots in the 60s and said, "What is my life? Here I am, a medical student. A few years' time I shall graduate, I shall go into practice, I shall start making money, I shall become wealthy, perhaps famous, I shall get married, I shall buy a big house, I shall have two cars. But what's it all for?" he says. "Where's it all going? The pointlessness of it all is so obvious to us when we're young, isn't it?" And then he said, "And the trouble is, when I'm 40, I think it's all wonderful." So true. Once we get enmeshed in climbing the greasy pole, that sort of objectivity fades, isn't it? We don't see it like that anymore. We just, like Paul Simon says, continue to pretend that our lives will never end and that flowers never bend in the rainfall. Now you listen to me, there is only one sort of success that cannot go stale in your mouth. And that's the sort of success David pursued by focusing his life's supreme ambition, not around materialistic goals, but around spiritual ones. Like Jesus said, "Seek first God's kingdom." I must have told you that story of the three workmen on the building site, like we've got outside here today. The interviewer on the television, you know, came up to them. "What are you doing?" he said to the first one. "I'm breaking rock," he said. "What does it look like?" "What are you doing?" he said to the second one. "I'm earning money to feed my wife and kids," he said. And he came to the third one. "What are you doing?" "Oh," he said, "I'm building a cathedral." See the difference? That was David. He wanted to build a church. He wanted to invest his life in eternity. He could have done anything he'd wanted to do when he got to Jerusalem. In 2 Samuel 7, the world was his oyster. Anything he wanted to do, anything he wanted to have, was his for the asking. Wouldn't you like to be in that position? What would you ask for? What would your supreme goal be if you could have anything in the world? David wanted a temple. Do you see what I mean about the spirituality of the man? He wanted to see his culture, his nation, centered around the lordship of God. Israel belonged to God. She wasn't a monarchy. She was a theocracy. The Lord was her king. He knew that. And he wanted to see that reign publicly celebrated. Shouldn't that be a Christian's ambition? Didn't Christ say all authority in heaven and earth was given to him? Didn't he die for this world? Doesn't the world belong to him? We have our elections, we have our troopings of the colour. But is it not true that he is the true king? It's upon his shoulder the real government rests, isn't it? Isn't that our faith? Isn't that what Christians believe? And that being so, should it not be our supreme passion to see his reign publicly acknowledged? We have no temple of cedar to build. The temple of the New Testament is made of living stones. Human beings, men and women, wooed from a life of moral rebellion and ignoring God into obedience and faith through the good news of Jesus. Baptized into the fellowship of his church. That's the temple we are building. Shouldn't we be building it? Shouldn't it be our supreme ambition to build the church? If you want to be successful, as David was successful, I advise you to do as he did. Invest your life around spiritual goals. I'm not saying material goals have no value, but they must not come first. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, Jesus said. And all these other things will fit into place. They will be yours as well. Make sure you seek it first. If you're going to do that, though, there are just a couple of lessons I'd like you to learn. As David had to learn. The first lesson he had to learn about building a temple was this, that God's work must be done God's way. He learned that lesson when he tried to bring the ark up to Jerusalem. This is in chapter 6 of 2 Samuel, the chapter just before. Now, in case anybody gets confused, this ark that you read about in chapter 6 of 2 Samuel has nothing whatsoever to do with Noah. It isn't a boat, it's a large box. And it held the two tablets of stone, which God had written the Ten Commandments on back in the time of Moses. On the lid there was a golden sculpture of two angels, which was thought of as a kind of throne for God. And at certain special times, God would appear in a shining cloud between the outstretched wings of these angels. So all in all, this ark was the most sacred religious object in Israel. It linked them with all the great events of their religion. Wherever the ark was, that would be where the people's religious shrine was. So if Jerusalem was going to become the central sanctuary, the ark must come there. For 20 years or more, it had been down in the house of a fellow called Abinadab, who'd been looking after it since the Philistines had captured it for a short period. Now David was determined to bring it back to where it ought to be, from Abinadab's house up to his new capital of Jerusalem. Unfortunately, David was a little careless about it. You'll see if you read 2 Samuel 6, that he went down to Abinadab's house with a whole regiment of his own soldiers. No doubt he thought it would be very appropriate if the ark had a military escort. He even had a new ox cart, a kind of thing with wheels like you see in India. He had that built especially to carry it. But I say he was careless, you see, because he'd forgotten that there were certain rules about carrying the ark. He should have known. It was the priests' prerogative to carry the ark, and that only by hand, never on a wheeled trolley. David hadn't forgotten that. He'd certainly ignored the point, but not for long, because we read that Uzzah, one of the sons of Abinadab, was accompanying the ark along the road as it was carried on this ox cart, and he saw it was going to fall off the cart, and he put out his hand to touch it to stop it falling, and immediately God struck him dead. David's initial reaction was, I suspect, a bit like yours and mine. Shocked horror. And then profound anger. How dare God do this kind of arbitrary thing? It's infuriating, God. You've spoilt the whole day. Here was I, planning a really nice party for you, God, to bring this ark up to Jerusalem. And what have you done? Made it into a funeral. So annoying, isn't it? And God won't let things work out the way we'd planned them. Oh, how he does ruin our parties sometimes. David vowed he wouldn't take the ark one step further. He left it right where it was, in the house of a fellow called Obed-Edom. But you see, God's work must be done God's way. That was the point. If you've got the aspiration to build a temple, then you must make sure you build it God's way. And when he had cooled down a bit and taken some time to reflect on what had happened, David realized that. 3 months later, he tried to move the ark again, but he'd learned his lesson by that time. We read in 1 Chronicles 15, David ordered only Levitical priests should carry the ark, because they are the ones the Lord has chosen to carry it. Wise after the event, you see. And so he took a company of priests down to the house of Obed-Edom. When they had carried the ark in the approved manner on poles for 6 steps successfully, he was so relieved he offered a bull and a calf in sacrifice. To make it quite clear to God, he had no intention of doing things any other way than God's way again. Well, the lesson is plain, you see. By all means, set yourself spiritual goals in life. Make it your ambition to do something for God, but make sure before you start that you've read this book. Because God's work must be done God's way. It's not service we offer if we offer him only our own ideas, but presumption. He won't be patronized by us. It's he who is the Lord of the church, and he must teach us how building the church is to be done. But you've got to give it to David. He was teachable. For some kings, a project like building a temple would have been a big ego trip. The idea of not being able to do things their way would have been an affront to their dignity. David didn't think that way. As far as he was concerned, it was God who was the real king, not him. And that attitude of voluntary self-abasement is what lies behind the strange incident at the end of chapter 6, and which brings us to the second little lesson I want you to notice when it comes to building temples. Choose a partner who will support you in your spiritual ambition. Look at verse 16 of 2 Samuel 6. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. Till very recently in the Middle East, to dance exuberantly was a way of showing honor. By making a fool of yourself, you threw extra dignity on the one you were trying to exalt in the eyes of others. That was the logic of it. And this is what we see David doing as he accompanies the ark. Instead of behaving as a king ought, with solemn and self-conscious majesty, he prances around like an idiot. He dances, his skirts go up in the air, he makes a complete ass of himself, you see. He's humiliating himself as he accompanies the ark in Jerusalem so as to give the glory to God, whose royal throne he's escorting. He's saying to the people, look, this isn't my party, it's God's. But Michal, his wife, couldn't stomach that. She was Saul's daughter, a princess. The pomp and ceremony of monarchy were important to her. She'd fallen in love with David in his youth when he'd come back from the defeat of the Philistines amidst the crowd's adulation. That's the way a king ought to enter a city. But to see him now making a spectacle of himself in this undignified manner like a court jester, well, it was just tasteless, if not obscene. Look at verse 20. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him. Notice that. She didn't wait till he got through the door. He's out on the street. How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would. Oh, the genius of the narrator. Do you see how many bells he rings with such an economy of words? Here is the proud princess asserting her royal disdain of her stupid husband. Here is an aging woman, perhaps, revealing sexual jealousy of the young slave girls. Was David showing a little bit more leg than she thought he should? Or is it even possible there was a Freudian echo here of the shame that her father had brought on the family when he scandalized the nation by dancing naked among the prophets during one of his fits of insanity? Oh, there are all kinds of echoes you can read into those words. But you see, David was different from her father. That was the fact of the matter. Saul wouldn't have bothered with the ark. He could scarcely be bothered with the prophet Samuel. Saul was the kind of king who erected monuments to his own achievements, not temples to the honor of God. But David was different. David was a man who more than anything else wanted to glorify God with his life. If he had one ambition, that was it. And unfortunately, Michal, though she loved David, she couldn't understand that element of spirituality in his personality. Do you see how he replies to her in verse 21? It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor. In other words, they've got more sense than you have, Michal. They understood what I was doing. And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. Was it a divine judgment, or did she simply forfeit David's favor by her tactless remarks? Either way, it's a salutary warning about the danger of marrying somebody who doesn't share our spiritual ambitions. If what she wants is affluence and prestige and houses and cars, is she going to understand if in 10 years' time you, like David, decide you want to build a temple? How's she going to think about that? Will she understand if you feel you have to make a bit of a fool of yourself in the eyes of the world for God's sake? Will she understand when you say God's work must be done God's way, my dear, no matter how costly to our pride? Will she understand? Because if she won't, think carefully before you link your destiny to hers. Choose a partner who will assist you in your spiritual ambition, not one who will be a hindrance to it. Yes, and just one third lesson, and quick lesson, about building temples. And that's this. That true religion is not me doing things for God. It's recognizing that God has done great things for me. We're back in chapter 7 and verses 4 and following. That night the word of the Lord came to Nathan saying, "Go tell my servant David, this is what the Lord says. Are you the one to build me a house to dwell in?" Strangely, David wasn't allowed to build his temple. That a surprise? He wanted to so much. He set his heart on it. It was the greatest thing he wanted to do. He would spend most of his life collecting the bits and bobs that his son Solomon would need to build it. But he wasn't allowed to put one stone on top of the other. Do you know why? Well, the logic of 2 Samuel 7 seems to be this. That David was trying to reverse the roles. "Have I ever suggested such a temple?" says God to David. "Did I ever mention it to Moses or to Gideon or to Samuel or one of the judges? Have I ever expressed discontent with my tabernacle shrine that I've had all these years?" No. "And who are you, David, to come up with the bright idea of building something more permanent for me?" Oh, I don't doubt the innocence of your motives. But don't you see, David? You're reversing the roles. You're trying to interest me in your projects. You're trying to seek my approval for your plans. You want my support for your schemes. That's reversing the role. Don't you realize, David, that's not what a relationship with me, the sovereign God, is all about? I'm the one who has the ideas, David. I expect obedience, not originality. Fine though your ambition is, David, I can't let you do it. It's not you that's going to build a house for me. Should I tell you what's going to happen, David? I'm going to build a house for you. That's the point of 2 Samuel 7. David comes to Nathan saying he's going to build a house for God, and Nathan comes back to David and says, "No, you're not. He's going to build a house for you." Do you get the point? See, there are two sorts of religion in this world. There is a religion in which men do things for God, and there is a religion in which God does things for men. There is a religion in which we are seeking to do God a favor, and a religion in which we are seeking the favor of God. To use the language of Paul, there are religions of works and there are religions of grace. And the religion of the Bible from cover to cover is a religion of grace. It is God who has the ideas. It is God who takes the initiative. It is God who makes the plans. And it is man who receives the blessing. It is man who obeys the commands. David here, with all the power and opportunity that had been given to him as king, was in danger of forgetting that and reversing the roles. He wanted with all his heart to do something for God, but spiritual pride is such a peril, God would not allow David to take that risk. No, David, you must content yourself with the knowledge that your son will build the temple you dream of. It isn't the great things you can do for me that I want to see, David.